It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a nationally known surgeon says when it comes to end-of-life care, we have a lot to learn.
First, we continue our series of news features on key races in next month's elections. Since moderate Republican State Senator Dale Schultz decided not to run for re-election, his open seat is considered a critical win for both parties seeking control of the legislature. Maureen McCollum has more on the candidates vying for the job in what's described as a fiercely independent district in rural southwest Wisconsin.
After months of campaigning, the 17th Senate District candidates finally met in a forum held at the American Legion this week in Mauston. The local Top 40 radio station plays music while the candidates mingle from table to table talking with voters. Republican candidate Howard Marklein is a state representative and Spring Green native. He says he was motivated to run for office a few years ago after money was taken out of the state's transportation fund.
I'm an accountant, I'm a CPA. Honest budgeting, being truthful with our taxpayers is very, very important to me. And that's one thing I'm going to fight for very, very hard, make sure we do not revert to some of the less than honest practices that were done in the prior administration.
Marklein has the support of groups like Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. It recently recognized him for voting 93% of the time on what it calls job creation legislation. His Democratic opponent, Pat Bomhack, has lived in the 17th Senate District for a few years. He's trying to start a law firm in Spring Green, but doesn't currently practice. Bomhack is quick to point out his admiration for the district's outgoing Senator Dale Schultz, a moderate Republican who is known for voting against his party.
I will be someone who builds consensus and seeks compromise, because we need more working together in Madison and less partisanship.
The state's Democratic leaders put their support behind Bomhack before the primary election, a move that upset prominent Democrats in the district who had their own candidate. During the forum, the candidates' differences were on display. Take rural school district funding. Bomhack wants to adjust the funding formula. He supports State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers' proposal, which guarantees a financial minimum for each student and shifts funding away from property taxes.
Our rural schools are so critical to our communities, and what I'm going to do as senator is fight to ensure that our rural schools are getting the funding that they deserve.
But Marklein says Evers' plan is too expensive. He says boosting enrollment would increase funding.
Declining enrollment underlies the majority of their concerns, and more than anything, we need good paying jobs out here. Once we've got, good jobs, families follow, families come, kids come, and some of that funding issue, goes away.
One of the voters carefully listening to the candidates during the forum is former state superintendent John Benson of Mauston. He says education funding and raising the minimum wage are major issues, so he's voting for Bomhack. Marklein says increasing the minimum wage could hurt employers, a stance Benson disagrees with.
It's a bunch of baloney. And for somebody to have to work for $7.25 an hour times 2,080 hours in a work year, they're absolutely on welfare. And it's sinful, especially when we see what some people are earning in this society and aren't paying enough in taxes to support a higher wage.
Cynthia Bomber of New Lisbon says she was impressed by Marklein's ideas at the forum and felt like Bomhack spent too much time attacking his opponent. She says that's one reason she'll be voting for the Republican.
Maintaining the progress that we made under Governor Walker with job creation and the stability that has been created, and I just want to preserve that.
Both parties want a victory in this district. If the Republicans win, they could maintain control of the state Senate. But a Democratic defeat could result in a power shift in the legislature. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Our next guest is a surgeon who's dealt with end-of-life issues both as part of his profession and in his personal family life.
He says we need to re-examine a lot of the things we do in nursing homes and hospitals and in our families and change the focus from extending life at all costs to maintaining a good life until the very end.
Dr. Atul Gawande joins us now. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a professor at Harvard Medical School, and his latest book is Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. He's speaking tonight at the Wisconsin Book Festival. That's at 7 p.m. at the Central Library in Madison. Dr. Gawande, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Well, you write that despite your years of medical training, you felt like you were unready to help patients deal with the realities they faced through years of decline and mortality. What was missing?
It's interesting. We really aren't trained in how to understand and think about mortality in medical school. You'd think we would. You know, we get the cadaver to dissect. Mm-hmm. But we really focus on understanding disease and then what you can do about disease. And we're good at handling the fixables, but not the great unfixables. When I got into practice as a surgeon, I found that a large percentage of my time was spent with people who had problems I couldn't fix: chronic illness, frailty, and then terminal illness. And while I was really competent at knowing how to handle the first set of problems, the second ones, we often cause more suffering than anything else.
And you worried that too much of our attention was on those fixables and the health and extending our survival versus a broader concept of well-being. How do we make that transition?
Well, I think the place that it starts, and it came from really looking at people who are very good at handling these problems, whether they were oncologists, palliative care doctors, geriatricians, it started by their recognizing that people have goals for their care besides just living longer. They have priorities. Those might be that I want to be cognitively intact, or I want to be able to be home more than at the hospital. The second insight was that the most reliable way to find out what people's priorities are is to ask about them. And we don't ask.
And you go beyond simply healthcare and look at the ways we provide care for older people, especially people dealing with health issues, and you apply some of the same concepts there. Looking at things like nursing homes and some things that call themselves assisted care facilities, you cite a sociologist saying, you know, in a lot of ways, we run these things like prisons.
It's totally true. Once you realize we're not asking people what their priorities are at the end of life, you start running up earlier along people's lives, and you realize we aren't asking them at any point where people are facing chronic impairment. So when you go in a nursing home, the priority is assumed to be your health and your safety. But can you have a drink in a nursing home, you know, at night? No. Can you go out and see your friends? Nobody's prioritized that. You know, the priorities are around things like we don't want you to fall. But what about loneliness? What about helplessness? And you realize you're a patient and not a person. I looked at a place, for example, that instead of building the nursing home around around the nursing station, you know, they all look like hospitals nowadays, they built it around a kitchen. And in the kitchen, you could go in the refrigerator and get whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted. You know how controversial that is?
Right. Yeah, I mean, from a medical perspective, people are thinking, you're going to let them handle knives. You're going to let them pick their own food? What about, there's a stove. There's a hot stove.
It might be unsafe. Mm-hmm. You know, a refrigerator, I mean, it could be that you have a diabetic taking a soda out of the refrigerator. How can we allow that? Or someone who has a medically ordered pureed diet, and they might steal a cookie. But you know what? 85-year-old, even with Alzheimer's, it's okay if they take the cookie. And we have to be able to understand people live for priorities bigger than just being alive.
And then how do we figure out that priority? So there's something more, you're saying, than living longer and avoiding a health condition that might, you know, hurt you, that might shorten your lifespan. How do we get to the core of that and define what a good life is, even as our health and maybe even our mental faculties are deteriorating?
Well, the key to it is that idea that we don't ask. And it turns out there's some skill that people have who are really good at asking. They ask certain kinds of questions. For example, instead of just giving you facts and figures about, you know, your survival rate and what might happen with this or that, they ask you, well, what's your understanding of your condition at this point in time? What are your fears and worries for the future? What are the goals you might have if your health worsens? And what are the outcomes that are unacceptable to you? When you understand what people are willing to sacrifice and what they're not willing to sacrifice, you get a picture of what matters to them, what they're really living for, and then you know where the bright lines are that you're not going to cross.
And finding meaning and finding a reason for being alive seems to be a key of a lot of what you write about. And you tell the story, among other people, of your own father as he left his profession. And you were worried about this. What does he do next? How did he start to find meaning above and beyond himself and above and beyond surviving?
He developed a brain tumor in his brainstem and spinal cord that was incurable, growing slowly. We knew it would claim his life. And I asked him those questions. I said, you know, what's your understanding of your condition? What are your hopes? What are your fears? And what he was able to articulate, we had this great conversation like we'd never had. I told him about a colleague's father who said, you know, if I can eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on television, that's good enough for me. Hmm. And my dad said, no way that's good enough for me. I want to be able to be socially interactive with people. And you know what was really important? He wanted to be able to Skype with family in India. He wanted to be able to email people. Well, you know, as long as we could preserve those capabilities, that guided us in many ways. He took surgery. He underwent surgery when he lost the ability to do surgery himself, and that helped buy him more time without quadriplegia. Then radiation therapy made him worse instead of better. And when he had the oncology options, all the chemotherapy options laid out before him, we could measure them according to, are they going to take away his ability to be awake and interactive with people, to be able to, you know, Skype with his family back home? And the options, you know, his world was narrowing enough that those options were going to take it away. And he made the choice to enter hospice rather than take chemotherapy, and actually lived longer than expected by avoiding the toxicity of therapies that were pushing him further down the hill.
You had this conversation with your father as a son. You've had it with patients as a doctor. Which was harder for you?
No question that there are parts that were much harder being the son. I was afraid that my father would think the worst of me, when in fact he was more prepared than I ever expected to have that conversation. The hard part with the patient is the fear that they're going to think you're not competent. What do you mean that you're worried that I may not, that everything may not turn out for the best? Aren't you giving me the best options? And being able to ask these questions and understand that these questions are not about saying, you're going to die. It's about saying, what are we fighting for and what are we going to make sure we preserve along the way here? You know, one nurse put it to me that the goals in medicine are often to sacrifice your time and quality of life now for the sake of possible time in the future. But as the chances of that possible time diminish and we sacrifice more and more of your life now, there are times when you start to ask, what if we ask for fighting for the best possible day today, regardless of what happens? What if we fight for making sure you are able to still do the things that are most important to you? And many people say that would be an amazing thing to still get to fight for.
We're talking to Dr. Atul Gawande about his new book, Being Mortal. He says we need to rethink the way we deal with the end of our lives, for ourselves, our families, our culture, and the medical profession.
And we want to hear from you. How has your own family dealt with the decline and death of a loved one? Looking back, would you have done things differently, geared more toward a good life in the moment rather than longevity? And if you're in the healthcare profession, what are you doing? What do you think we're doing right? And what are we doing wrong? What could we do better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a surgeon, a Harvard Medical School professor, and the author of Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End.
You can join our conversation about the ways we deal with the end of life, from nursing homes to hospice care to medical treatment. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to our callers, Dr. Gawande, one story you tell is about an experiment with pets at a nursing home.
Yeah, in upstate New York, a guy who calls himself a nursing home abolitionist named Bill Thomas was the nursing home director of a place where he said they have the three plagues of boredom, loneliness, and helplessness, and it depressed even him. And so he said this place needs life. And he said, what if we brought in pets? And not as like pets who could, you know, be managed by animal handlers, pets that could belong to the people who live there. And they went up against the New York State regulators and asked for a waiver from the rules. And he didn't just bring in a dog or two dogs. He brought in two dogs, four cats, and 100 birds.
Wow.
And they belonged to the people who lived there. So, you know, you could own your own cat. You could own your own pair of birds. And people, when they suddenly had responsibility, even an Alzheimer's patient could care for another being, they suddenly had purpose that they could live for. People came out of their shells, but they talked more. Their use of medications declined for psychosis, for anxiety. Their levels of satisfaction rose, and they actually lived longer. Now, the nursing home would have said, well, I was keeping them safe. But here, they were not tending to their purpose until they started to bring these elements in. And, you know, we'd take for granted that you go into a place like that, well, you can't have your pets anymore. But it's heartbreaking for people.
So, again, it's maybe not so much the pets themselves, but the humanity, the human expression that they brought out in the people.
Yeah. You know, what people have are loyalties. You know, it was a 19th century philosopher that I wrote about named Josiah Royce, who talked about the idea that intrinsic to people's lives, it's not just being healthy and safe, and that we're living in a time when no matter how old you were always at risk of death. And so what he was raising is, why is it unsatisfying just to be alive and safe? And the answer was, he said, was because we live for some ideals that are bigger than us, that we're willing to sacrifice our health and safety for. That might be for our children. It might be for our country. It might be for God. It might be for a pet. And the chance to care for and give of ourselves is something we need throughout our lives, even when we can be cognitively impaired.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Tim on the line in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. I had a similar kind of situation. I was a satellite installer for years, and I had a customer's wife give me all of the gentleman's cigars and told me not to smoke, but gave them to me because he was dying of lung cancer and shouldn't be smoking anymore. He was stage 3 lung cancer, well into his 90s. I want to say he was 97. And I found a box of pre-embargo Cuban cigars. I put them in his boat. I called him. I told him where they were. Because to me, you don't get rid of your vices when you're 97 years old and dying of lung cancer.
It's a fascinating thing. I'm glad you bring this up. You know, if health and safety are the preeminent, I write about my wife's grandmother who went into a nursing home and they took away things that were really important to her. You know, the particular foods that she loved because they weren't necessarily safe. The chance for a drink at night. The because it wasn't always the healthiest thing to do. But the chance to make these choices, you know, an 85-year-old with Alzheimer's who's told you can't have cookies anymore because you have to be on a pureed diet. And what did you see? Most commonly, people get written up for violating the food rules or violating the smoking rules. But when you're 85 years old with Alzheimer's and you're stealing cookies, like, let him have the damn cookies or let him have that cigar at that point in his life, or at least let him make the choices to be able to do so. It is out of a recognition that, you know, I'm going to argue with my patients to say you shouldn't smoke and you should put on your seatbelt. But I'm also not going to put him in a prison which says you have no choices whatsoever. You have no ability to balance the risks. And these are places across the country now that have, there are many of these places that have found ways to allow people to take risks without ending up with malpractice suits or an inability to make these places work. And in fact, those places have equal or better survival as a result.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to George in Milwaukee next. George, hi.
Hi. You know, similar to the guest, I had my dad was in a health decline for several years, and you know, although his situation was very challenging physically, he was able to participate over a 4-year period in the birth of 2 of my sons, and you know, looking back at it now, I can't imagine that he wouldn't have been around during that period, but. What really resonated with me was the whole highly subjective nature of quality of life. And if the guest could please share his perspectives on how he's seen different patients define that.
It is highly different from person to person. There are some common elements. Most people want to be connected to people who know them and love them. And they're living in places that don't necessarily foster those kinds of relationships. They don't ask, how do we keep you connected to people that you are close to? You know, when you go in a nursing home, you're suddenly cut off from the outside world, and that's not being sustained. Another common element is almost everybody has something larger than themselves that they're living for. And that differs from person to person, whether it's, as I mentioned, you know, political campaigns or certain ideals or just their children or the country. And making ways that they can be connected to those larger goals are really important. Now, there is that subset who become cognitively impaired, but even they are expressing themselves all the time. I tell the story of Ruth Barrett, lived in a low-income housing facility run by this amazing woman in northern Massachusetts who said, I'm going to keep them in their homes and let them make choices, even though she was with severe Alzheimer's disease, had lost the last 30 years of her life, was in a wheelchair. Well, she was expressing every day that what she loved to do was be with people, and she loved to eat, and there was no bigger joy for her than going out to a restaurant. And so they arranged. Once a week, she could go out with her friends. She always loved to go to TGI Fridays. They went to TGI Fridays. She'd order a margarita against all the rules and hang out with her friends. They'd triple up on the Depends, and they'd make it happen. And it didn't cost more money. It just meant that they shifted their priorities about time. They didn't make priorities for bingo and very passive group entertainment. They made priorities for kind of unscheduled, spontaneous time, which is the kind we all live and have.
Well, as we wrap up, are we as a culture and maybe the medical profession also shifting our priorities? Are you seeing a change in our concept of the right way to reach the end of our lives?
I think we are. We are used to saying, you know, America's way behind the rest of the world. Honestly, I found in the research that much of the world, Europe has a similar, you know, we think it's very different, but over 65, about 25% or so of our health spending here and abroad is on the end of life. But there's a change underway right now. In the late 90s, more than 80% of us died in institutions behind curtains. Today, it's risen to more than 45% dying in hospice, with about half of those people being in hospice at home and half in hospice centers outside of hospitals and other healthcare institutions. We're all getting more experience with being around people who die and seeing that it could be something that has moments worth cherishing and that are really important to us, important for the meaning of our lives.
Dr. Gawande, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Atul Gawande, surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. His new book is Being Mortal, and he's speaking tonight at the Wisconsin Book Festival. That's 7 o'clock tonight at the Central Library in Madison.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll check out a nationwide program that aims to connect high-achieving, low-income students with the best universities and financial aid.
First, when was the last time you paid $2-something a gallon for gas? Well, for many Americans, it might have been yesterday. According to AAA, gas prices at nearly half of the gas stations in the United States fell below $3 on Thursday.
That decrease is part of a global trend that saw oil prices fall from $150 a barrel in mid-June to under $85 by mid-October. This sounds like it could be good news for consumers who are paying less at the pump. In the long term, it may point to a slowdown in the global economy.
Here to talk with us about the trends and what they mean for the average consumer is Abdur Chaudhry, economics professor at Marquette University and former chief economist for the UN Economic Commission in Europe. Abdur, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on your program.
What do we know about why gas prices are down?
There are a couple of reasons why gas prices are falling. Obviously, the most important being that the price of crude oil is dropping in the international market. And as you said, it's about $82 now per barrel. Add to that two other things that are happening within the country. Basically, we have seen historically after Labor Day, usually people drive less, so there is less demand for gas. And also during this time of the year, the refineries usually switch from summer blend to winter blend gas. And for winter blend gas, the environmental restrictions are not as much, so it costs less to produce winter blend gas. So all of these are sort of adding together to provide this relief for consumers.
So is it typical then that in the winter gas costs less?
Yes. Compared to summer gas, you will see the winter blend gas cost a little bit less. However, this time, this year, we are feeling it much more because of the drop in gas price in the international market.
Now, it seems like for consumers, this is a no-brainer. This is good news that they're paying less at the pump. Is it good news for everybody?
I would say in the short run for the United States, it is good news. With consumers paying less for gas, they will now have an extra money that they can spend on other products. Business firms, airline industries, they will be paying less for fuel. So in the short run, it will be good news for the U.S.
Does that mean, for instance, we're going to see lower airfares?
I'm not sure with her, airline industry will lower the airfare because they will always have some other excuse for keeping airfare high. But for airline industry, the cost of fuel will significantly drop, yes. And so, the question is whether they will lower the air price because of that drop in cost.
To put this into context, when was the last time we saw prices this low?
It was at least a couple of years ago. If you remember, I don't think we saw price so low before 2007, 2008. That's when price was below $3 per gallon.
Wow. So how long do you expect this sort of thing to last? Are we going to see a bottom and then ricochet back up again, or is it something different, do you think?
What I'm expecting is that you will see price continue to drop for the next couple of weeks, at least towards the end of November, and price can drop to $2.75, $2.70 per gallon. Then the OPEC countries, they're having a meeting November 27th where they may decide to cut production in order to raise prices. If they decide to cut production, then you will see gas prices going up a little bit in November.
Now, you have said that this is good news for consumers, good news overall, but does it signal anything worrisome about the overall global economy?
I would say the fact that prices are declining in the international market, this is due to a slowing down in a number of regions around the world. If you know the Eurozone countries, they're not doing very well. In Europe, their economy is slowing down. China, we have seen in recent months, their economy has slowed down. So, and because of the slowing down in the global economy, there is less demand for oil in the international market. So we see a supply glut. So in the short run, I don't see any specific impact on the U.S. economy, an adverse impact. But for example, if the slowdown in the global economy continues for a long time, this may have an adverse impact on the U.S. economy in the long run.
Now,
By long run, I mean, say, 6 months down the road.
Gotcha. Well, parts of the United States have benefited from a natural gas and oil boom thanks to hydraulic fracking technology. And that technology, though, it's expensive. And if oil prices continue to fall, or at least to level out, do you think that could make fracking less profitable?
It might. For fracking industry shale gas, sort of $75 per gallon, per barrel of oil price, that's the break-even point. So currently, a barrel of oil is selling at $82. If it drops below $75, you might see some problem in the oil industry in the U.S.
What is the longest we've ever seen gas prices fall like this and stay low? You mentioned maybe several months out, at least the end of November, but what is the longest we've seen?
The longest gas prices declining like this we have seen, we go back to the 2007 period. That's when we saw gas prices decline and stay low for a couple of months, in fact.
Now, oftentimes when there is a rise in oil prices, you can point to something that's happening in terms of domestic conflict. And in this case, I'm curious about whether you think the events, with ISIS and Syria and Iraq could have had any effect on what we're talking about here.
It's not having an impact yet. The reason is because the countries in the Middle East that are producing oil, they haven't reduced their production. They basically are continuing to produce a large amount of oil. That's why we are seeing the glut. Also, Russia is producing, they're supplying a significant amount of oil in the international market. So the glut that we see in the international market, that will continue in the coming weeks.
Now, the United States is still easing its way out of a recession, getting back on stable footing. Based on these oil prices and the overall picture, is there anything, big picture here that we should be looking at that could be a signal or a bellwether about the U.S. economy?
The U.S. economy, compared to other regions around the world, is doing reasonably well. There are some pockets of weaknesses here and there, But overall, I would say the U.S. economy is doing pretty well compared to, say, Europe or Japan. Now, going down the road, as I said, in the short run, this drop in oil price is good for our economy. However, one thing that has happened is the dollar has strengthened in value in the last couple of weeks. Now, if dollar stays strong, and if the European economy in particular doesn't improve, the economic condition doesn't improve in the next couple of months, then that will start affecting the U.S. economy. The reason is we export about anywhere from 16 to 20% of our total export goes to Europe. So if the European economy do not improve, that will have an adverse impact on our economy.
Okay, something to watch for. Abdur, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me on your program. Thanks.
We've been talking about falling oil prices with Abdur Chaudhry, economics professor at Marquette University and former chief economist for the UN Economic Commission in Europe. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The high cost of higher education has been a big topic in Wisconsin and beyond. And for low-income students in particular, many of the nation's best-known colleges and universities are not a realistic option, even for academically talented kids.
The organization QuestBridge is trying to change that by connecting high-achieving, low-income students with colleges and financial aid around the country.
Leslie Sullivan joins us now. She's director of student relations for QuestBridge. And by the way, she grew up in Northern Wisconsin. Leslie, welcome back to the state.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on today.
So what is the problem that QuestBridge is trying to tackle?
Sure. As kind of the introduction mentioned, I think what we're really trying to do is increase the percentage of talented low-income students that are attending our country's best colleges and universities. As we, as a country, try to stay competitive in the global economy, it's going to be important to kind of reach for students from all economic backgrounds to kind of contribute to the diversity of opinions that we're seeing in the students that are being educated at these schools.
Now, when I think of a student maybe in a low-income area, they might be academically talented. Maybe they could even get into the college of their choice and get financial aid there, but with so many choices out there, it might be overwhelming to know how to get that. How do you try to bridge that gap?
Sure. So, you know, a large piece of what we do is education. So we really try to teach students about the financial aid options that are out there. And there are a large number of schools across the country who are kind of these schools that are these top schools. Everyone thinks, oh, I could never afford to attend there. But they often have significant need-based financial aid that makes that affordable and makes it the equivalent or cheaper to attend one of these top schools than it is even a local community college.
Well, let's look at this from the student side. How do you connect with high school students around the country and bring them on board?
Sure. So we are a small organization based out of California. And so we're unfortunately not really able to kind of be on the ground going into the classrooms and that type of thing. So we have kind of a large national outreach that we do through kind of email and mail. And we really try to work a lot with teachers and organizations that might have contact with students to get them to apply to our programs. And kind of our first program that we do in a student's life cycle is a program called the College Prep Scholarship for High School Juniors. And that happens in the spring of the junior year for students. And if they're selected through that program, we try to coach them through the college admissions process and offer them resources to make them more competitive college applicants.
And then what happens when they're seniors and actually filling out those applications?
Sure. So as a senior, we have our application process, which is earlier than early, I always say. So our deadline is the end of September, which is a lot earlier than early applications for any schools. But that's because students are kind of able to get a jump start with us, and then we review their applications, and they can kind of use those as the start of an application with our partner schools, who are top colleges across the country, who are guaranteeing to meet full need for any student that's admitted there. And we'll kind of help them understand the process for applying to those schools and give them guidance along the way to a higher level than the broad student population might get.
And you said full costs. I mean, are we talking tuition, room and board, textbooks, meals, and on?
Exactly. It's the full cost of attendance. So they're meeting the full need of the students. So that might be, you know, if there's a student in Wisconsin who's choosing to go to a school that is out of state and has to pay to travel there, that would be part of the cost of attendance. And financial aid can help to cover that type of expense.
And you mentioned kids from Wisconsin. We have seen Wisconsin students get involved and go through this program?
Yes, we have. We've certainly, I don't off the top of my head here have the numbers of Wisconsin students, but we have a large number of students that do apply from Wisconsin and go through the process. And it's something that it's not, it's something that's designed to just help them understand all the options available to them and what the right fit is for them. So it might be something that's closer to them or it might not be. And that's really our ultimate goal, is to help students reach their full potential. And there was a recent study last year done that kind of showed for low-income, high-achieving students, a low proportion. So only about 8% of them are applying to schools in the way that they should be applying. Well, high-income students, only 64% of them are applying in the way that they should. So that's that 8 versus that 64. So we're just trying to narrow that gap a little bit.
Now, suppose a student or a family member or a high school counselor is listening right now and thinking, wow, I know somebody that this could apply to. How would they get started? How do they get rolling on getting connected with you?
Sure. So if anybody knows of anybody, you can always refer students to us through our website at www.questbridge.org. And we have a right on the homepage a refer a student button, and that just tells us about the student and then when the student's kind of eligible to apply for our program. So we're starting our program for juniors or the program for seniors. We'll reach out to the student and let them know that that's open.
Now, flipping to the other side of the equation, you mentioned partner universities. Can you give us examples of a few of the universities and colleges that work with QuestBridge?
Sure. So, some of our initial schools that we started to work with are Amherst, Rice, Trinity College in Connecticut. And then we also have some larger name schools, Princeton, Stanford, Yale, MIT. It's really a broad mix of schools across the country, universities and liberal arts colleges, schools in big cities, schools in small areas, and just a good kind of combination of characteristics to give students a lot of options.
And I wonder, from the school perspective, what's in it for them? What do they see themselves getting out of reaching out to these high-achieving but low-income students they might not ordinarily see applications from?
Sure. You know, I think any of the schools that do partner with us have an institutional commitment to getting these students onto their campus and supporting them while they're there. And that's really about kind of increasing the diversity on our campuses, which is very important to these schools and to us. As I said at the beginning, and kind of really thinking about where as a nation we want to go and remain competitive, to have a broad range of backgrounds is important.
Now, are you looking, I know you're looking to recruit more students for the program, are you also looking for more schools to get involved? And in particular, I don't think I saw any Wisconsin institutions on the list.
Sure. You know, we're not actively recruiting schools right now. However, if there are schools that feel that they fit kind of our partner school model, they'd be free to reach out to us. But it really does require a significant commitment on the school level, both in terms of that institutional commitment to wanting to recruit and support these students, and then also to what I mentioned earlier, they need to be able to commit to meeting 100% of demonstrated need for all of the students that are admitted, regardless of how they get into the school. And then they also, through our early program, students can match with a school, and for those students, they need to commit to meeting their full financial aid with no parent contribution, no loans for all 4 years. So it's a significant commitment that our partner colleges are making to work with us.
Well, I know our listenership occasionally includes university administrators. If one of them's out there and is thinking, yeah, we should check this out, how does a school go about looking at the criteria and seeing if this is a good fit for them?
Sure. Yeah, you know, if they think that they're a good fit, they could certainly email us at questions@questbridge.org, and we would forward that on to our partner relations team who handles those relationships.
Now, getting into the program a little more deeply, how long have you been at this?
So the Quest Scholars Program, which is kind of our overarching program, started in 1994 as a five-week summer program to help this type of student prepare them for college. And in about 2004, or 2003 was actually the first year of it, 2004 was when they were starting out college, we switched to kind of this current model in an effort to scale, whereas before with a residential program, the cost was quite a bit higher and we were only able to help about 20 to 40 students per year, whereas now we have close to 2,000 students attending our partner colleges each year.
And are you starting to see a lot of success stories where you're seeing the people going through this program making it through the college of their choice?
We are. It's been really nice. You know, as that timing kind of might note, there at the beginning it obviously was much smaller. So now we're starting to see a larger number of students graduating each year, and we're able to kind of see what they're going off and doing, and we're kind of to the point where they're reaching back out to us and being in touch. So it's really great to kind of see all the places they're going and the things they're doing. And, you know, much like schools, we see our Fulbright scholars and our Rhodes scholars and students going to all the big different companies. And it's nice to know that we had a part in that.
And are the graduates of Quest Bridge, if I can call them graduates, starting to recommend people maybe from their family, their hometown give it a try?
They are. We actually have a really strong ambassadors program that students who are currently in college even participate in helping us to reach out to students who might be thinking about applying. So they help us make phone calls, they go out and do presentations, and they're kind of our on-the-ground army to get all of that done since there's so few of us here in the office.
Well, Leslie, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Leslie Sullivan of Wisconsin originally. She's Director of Student Relations for the organization Quest Bridge.